Hi, this is Michael Brown for our town hall meeting today on jobs and a living wage. Sorry for the delay. We're having technical difficulties, so we're coming to you on the phone. But we hope that you'll call in and be part of the discussion. And we'll give you the number in just a minute.
Hello.
Hey,
are you with us, Kathleen?
Okay. we have to do this on the phone, guys, because the internet is down on our end, the people that are producing the show. So we're going to go ahead with the show, and we're sorry if you tuned in at 2 o'clock like you were supposed to, and we haven't gotten on. But go ahead, Kathleen. Let's go.
Yes, hello. Sorry about this, everyone. You know, this is what happens when you're using a new technology, which I'm sure probably in a year will be the way everybody does it. Anyway, good afternoon, and welcome to our third town hall meeting. I want to say that I think our first two meetings have gone great, and I'm looking forward to today's forum on jobs and a living wage, something I'm very interested in. We will hold two more forums at 2 p.m. on the next two consecutive Sundays with candidate for D.C. City Council at Large, Michael D. Brown. I am your moderator, Kathleen Gomez, and I am here to facilitate the conversation, propose questions to the candidate, and make sure that these meetings provide the kind of information you need to make an informed choice in the upcoming November election for D.C. City Council at Large. These town hall meetings are designed to give you, the voter, the opportunity to call in and have your concerns addressed by the candidate, your questions answered, and your voice heard on the issues that are most important to you and to our city. We hope you will join in the discussion by calling in at 888-429-5471. Again, the number is 888-429-5471, or you can Skype your questions to BBS Radio 2. Each town hall meeting will be conducted on this internet platform for an hour on Sundays at 2 p.m. They will each deal with a different topic, and the final one will be on Sunday, October the 19th, and will be an open forum, so you can call in with any question that you might have. As I said today, today's discussion will focus on jobs and a living wage in the district. I would like to point out, however, that you are always free to ask a question on whatever issue is most important to you. I will take as many questions as possible, and I reserve the right to limit the time to ask or answer any one question. Let me point out that any question that remains unanswered at the end of the meeting can be submitted to Mr. Brown's website, www.michaeldbrown2014.com. Now let me introduce the candidate, Michael D. Brown, for an opening statement. Good afternoon, Mr. Brown. It's a beautiful, beautiful day in D.C. The weather is just great. And I look forward to an interesting and lively discussion. How are you?
I'm fine, except that we're having technical difficulties. And again, we're sorry for anybody out there that might be listening and tuned in at the right time. We're sorry we got a late start due to some technical difficulties on our platform in California. But we'll try to get those straightened out for the next meeting. And I hope everybody can hear us okay. I'd like to start out with an opening statement. 70% of the people working in the District of Columbia live outside its boundaries. The unemployment rate east of the river is more than double what it is in the rest of the city. Although our city is thriving with more than 76 cranes active throughout the city, too many of our citizens remain unemployed. We need to enforce first source laws, provide more technical education, and develop jobs for D.C. residents. To do this, we must partner with business and government to produce more training and better permanent jobs. For example, our region is now the home to the headquarters of the world's two largest hotel chains, Marriott and Hilton. In spite of this fact, we only have a small hospitality program that enrolls very few students in our D.C. public school system. Although a few new programs have been started, they are still inadequate and need to be substantially increased. We need to develop new training and employment programs with these two giant worldwide corporations to provide careers here in D.C., where we have literally hundreds of hotels and restaurants. Walk into any hotel in Washington and ask an employee where he or she lives, and they're likely to say Maryland or Virginia. we need to change this by preparing D.C. residents for some of these jobs. In addition, one out of every four new jobs created in the next 5 years in the region will be a federal government job. Again, we need programs that partner with D.C. public schools and the federal government to prepare district students for some of these good jobs and future careers. St. Elizabeth's, the D.C. United Soccer Stadium, the Frederick Douglass Memorial Bridge Project represent billions of dollars in public works money. The city needs to work with employers, unions, and the federal government to make sure that D.C. residents get priority in training and job placement on these projects. Developing new infrastructure and developing new career paths for D.C. residents should go hand in hand, especially when city money is involved. In addition, in this time of great largesse in our city, every high school graduate should get free tuition to our new community college. A series of job programs aimed at training students for local jobs in areas like construction management, food service, and graphic design should be developed around two-year degree and certificate programs. In addition to preparing students for a four-year degree, our community college should first and foremost serve our community. A two-year degree can lead to a good career, and someone who has completed a two-year program is much more likely to complete a bachelor's degree program. Young people who don't see that they have a bright future have a harder time dealing with the present. Residents with good jobs become good taxpayers and stay where the jobs are. We must, as a community, invest in the growing middle class, because our city, comprised of only rich and poor, will cease to flourish. We must also raise the minimum wage to a level of a living wage in the district. Currently, a full-time minimum wage earner cannot afford to live in our city. We must raise the minimum wage to $12.50 an hour immediately and increase it based on inflation over time. We must also support check-the-box legislation. It's time, D.C., to develop more good jobs for Washingtonians and develop Washingtonians for more good jobs. Thanks.
Well, that's really interesting, especially, you know, I guess one of my questions to you would be, it seems that D.C., since, you know, I've been away for a while and I've come back, it's just grown and become very, very, I guess, economically, it looks like it's been going through good times. Because as I look to come back into the city, I'm looking at $3,000 apartments. And so I'm wondering, who are these people that are working in the city that have so much money? Are they people that are working for the federal government, or is it just the economics of the place that it's getting such a, I guess, number one destination point to live?
Well, I think a lot of what we see in the growth of the city, more than anything, is a group called millennials, which is coming. These are people that are coming in numbers of 1,200 a month. The city was at one time had a population of well over 800,000. So we're still about 25% short in terms of population than we were in the 1980s. But we are growing rapidly, and development is happening rapidly. We have a lot of foreign investment in the city, for one thing. Many of the construction projects that are going on now are investments from outside the country and certainly outside our city. So that's caused an increase in development. And the increase in rents is really due more to, you know, supply and demand than anything else. And unfortunately, we're forcing a lot of long-term residents in the city out. We have a lot of areas that are being gentrified, and this is a big problem in our city. And people that have lived here for years are now being forced out because they can no longer afford to live here. In addition to that, you know, you have people like me who have lived in this city for more than 30 years, and I certainly bought my house at a good time, and it's tripled in value. But my children can't live here. They can't afford to live here. So that's a real problem. And the new people that are moving in are people that have good jobs, I think, lawyers and sometimes not a lot of federal workers. Most federal workers live in Virginia and Maryland.
But the rents are less expensive?
Yeah, much less expensive. An apartment, I just looked, an apartment in Largo, Maryland, which is, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes from the city, two bedrooms, $1,100 a month, as opposed to two bedrooms in the city in most neighborhoods costing $3,000 or more.
So the people, you know, having lived in Manhattan for a long time, I saw this happen right before my eyes, and I see this already, you know, probably deep into going in that direction, is where it becomes so expensive that the people who run the grocery stores, the people who do the services, maybe work in the museums, maybe they're already not living in D.C., but you kind of really cut that kind of, you know, service employee out of being able to live in the city that he works, right? I mean, this seems to me that this is going to be a big problem. You're just going to have people living in the district who are making very, very, I mean, huge amounts of money in their job versus people who service, you know, work in the service industry.
Well, that's a problem, and we certainly have that problem now. We have so many new and, you know, like big box stores and other things moving into the city, but which bring with them jobs, but those people can't afford to live in D.C. If you make the minimum wage, now it's in D.C., and we it seems like we're moving on to living wage pretty quick here, but you're making $8.25 an hour, and that is $330 a week before taxes. I mean, that's just incredible that, you know, you're going to make $1,300 a month or not even $16,000 a year, and that's before you pay your taxes. So after taxes, you're making $1,000 a month, and you can't afford to live in the city on $1,000 a month.
So then the parts of the city that I see that have not gone through this gentrification or that type of thing, actually, you know what? Let me come back with that question because we have a caller on line two. Denise?
Great.
Hello, Denise.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Good.
Yes.
Are you with
us? Can
you hear me? Yeah.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear us? We can hear you.
I can. You can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I know that the tax commission report that came out recently had a job tax for employers in it. The city council turned it down. And I thought that that was a good thing, because if you tax jobs in the city, it will only work against creating new jobs. I heard you recently say at a forum that you thought it was a bad idea. I really don't understand why you think it's a bad idea. Can you explain that more, please?
Yeah, actually, that's a really good question. Thanks for calling it, Denise. Just to explain, I think that turning down the tax was a bad idea. I think we should have a tax, and I think it was a small tax. It was $100 for each employer in the city, that for each employee that works outside the city. Now, when I ran a business in the district, I was taxed that much as an employer just to build the new national stadium several years ago. So it's not a big tax, but 70% of the people that work in the District of Columbia live outside the District of Columbia, and we're not allowed to tax them. We're the only jurisdiction in the country where this is true, because Congress controls all the laws here in the district. So that $100 would have been essentially a fee that was paid to help offset the cost that we pay as taxpayers in the District of Columbia for things like our street maintenance and fire and emergency equipment and all the things that we have to pay to keep the city running, because there's only 30% of us that actually have to do that, since 30% of us that work here, since 70% of the people live outside the city. So they turned down that idea. If you lived in New Jersey and you worked in Manhattan, you would pay that in 10 days going through the Holland Tunnel back and forth to work. So it's not very much, $100 a year, but they turned it down. And instead, they passed what's been commonly known as the yoga tax, a tax on health clubs and other types of services in the district, which is just, in my opinion, outrageous, because we shouldn't be taxing things that make you healthier. We shouldn't tax bicycles, and we shouldn't tax health clubs, and we shouldn't tax things that actually lower our long-term costs in this city, healthcare costs. We should be taxing people that use our city services and don't have to pay anything for them. And that's why I thought it was a bad idea that they refused to accept that $100 fee for employers. And that, just by the way, would be paid by the employer and not by the employee. So I don't know if that straightens it out for you, Denise, but that's the way I felt about it.
I think Denise, she must have liked your answer because she's left.
Sure.
But I wanted to ask you something. You know, I was thinking about this yoga tax, and it seems to me that maybe the assumption is that, well, people who go to health gyms or whatever can afford the 5% tax. But then I was at a community school, I guess, and inside there were people, older women, there's quite a few of them taking a class, and I'm sure they have to pay for that. You know, it's probably a minimal fee, but maybe they pay $20 a month or something to go to classes in the high school gym taught by somebody. Would they also have to pay that tax, or is it just through a business membership?
Yeah, no, I think it's just on health clubs. I'm not sure that it applies. That's a good question. I'm not sure that it applies to nonprofits, you know. And a lot of those people that do things like that in community centers and, schools and things like that either do it for free or they do it for a very nominal fee. It's usually provided, I think, throughout the city. There are several courses that are provided by nonprofit groups. So I think they're probably exempt from the tax. It's only for-profit businesses, and it really applies to a whole group of service businesses, but it's been given the nickname the yoga tax because gyms and yoga studios are among the businesses to which it applies. So
I see. Well, that's good to know that it's not, because you could tell those people, they're older women, they're on a fixed income, and they don't, 5% doesn't sound much, but, an extra dollar here and two, it all comes to the bottom line.
Well, and absolutely. And just as a rule of thumb, I mean, for me, I don't want to get too far afield here, but I don't think you should tax things that make you healthier, because we have a lot of health problems in the District of Columbia. For example, we have among the highest rate of type 2 diabetes anywhere in the country, and exercise and yoga and going to the health club reduces the amount of type 2 diabetes you have in the population, and in the long run, it saves the city a lot of money. So I don't think it's just a good idea to tax things like that. We often refer to sin taxes, taxes on cigarettes and alcohol and other things that are unhealthy for you. So I think we should be just using the absolute opposite philosophy with things that are healthy for you and not tax them at all.
Well, I don't want to get astray, but as you can see, there's always so much talk when you're dealing with jobs and wages and how you live in the community and what you live in. So let's go back to jobs. As somebody who's been away for a while, come back, it seems like I see a lot of wealth on the street, unbelievable expensive cars, and then, I would say blue-collar type of car, just somebody who's getting from one point to the other. And I'm wondering, is the job market in D.C. basically now geared for people who are those who have master and graduate degrees? Do you see a job market that's in D.C. that is more, blue-collar or middle-class, I should say, nowadays?
Well, I think that, first of all, the District of Columbia, it really is two separate cities, and that's we need to change that. But we have more graduate degrees. It's funny that you say graduate degrees, because we have more graduate degrees in the District of Columbia than any city in the entire world. So certainly we are attracting those types of people. Unfortunately, we also have an illiteracy rate that's just astounding. A third of our population is illiterate. They can't read the newspaper. Unemployment, as far as jobs go, unemployment in the city dropped at the beginning of the year to about 8%. It's the lowest it's been in 4 or 5 years. But unfortunately, in Anacostia, it's come down also in Anacostia, but it's still at above 17%. So it's more than twice as much on east of the Anacostia River in the poorer wards of the city. So we need to really address this problem, because it's true. We're a city of two distinct populations, and one is poor and one is pretty wealthy. I think you're right. I mean, I'm astounded at the amount of Teslas I see on the street. I know that's a car that costs upward of $100,000, but I see a few of them every day. Obviously, we have some very, very wealthy people. We constantly say, as you probably know, I've been the advocate for statehood in the District of Columbia for the past 8 years as an elected United States senator. And we often complain that we don't have representation and we pay the highest per capita federal income taxes in the country. Well, the reason we pay the highest per capita income taxes in the country is that we're the wealthiest people in the country. So there's a lot of wealth here, but there's also a lot of poverty. And my opinion is, if we become a city of rich and poor people, we'll never be able to sustain ourselves.
Well, you know, it's obvious to me, coming in after even coming from, you know, out southwest, is that you don't really have, it seems to me, a middle class anymore. There used to be one. You know, I was here in the 70s and 80s, and there was definitely the different, you know, social classes. I mean, you know, blue collar, there was always, you know, the poor and those who didn't have a job, which was always really high. But there was a middle class, and I just don't see that anymore. And if there is, they live in Virginia and they live in Maryland. And it's sad, because I don't think a city can sustain itself like that either. So what would you do to create, what kind of jobs would you want to create, or would see that the city council could be, you know, effective in trying to create jobs in D.C.?
Well, you know, one thing that we could do, there's several things we could do, but one thing we can do is get serious about workforce development. We talk about it and talk about it on the city council, but they really don't do much. They've tried a few initiatives, but they've all been half-hearted and failed. So we need to put some real muscle behind creating jobs in the District of Columbia. And some of the ways we could do that are, one, we could partner with the federal government. You know, this is the home of the federal government, and the federal government, much to our chagrin, controls many things in the city, but they treat us like poor stepchildren. One out of every four jobs in the region in the next 5 years that will be created will be a federal government job. We ought to partner with the federal government to have job programs in our high schools that help prepare kids for students for government jobs. There used to be programs like this. There was a really famous one at Largo High School right outside the District of Columbia. And over the years, I've met several people that work in the federal government that were products of that program. We should also reach out and provide, through our new community college, we have a new community college, we should give every high school graduate that graduates from a district high school free tuition to our community college. You know, if you, through a thing called TAG program, which is a federal program, if you send your kid to a state school outside the District of Columbia, you get up to $10,000 a year in tuition assistance. Well, that should also extend to kids that want to stay in the District of Columbia. We should give them free tuition to our community college, and we should develop two-year programs at our community college that really serve the community. I worked my way through college and graduate school, and I started my education at a community college in Montgomery County, and it was very oriented to the community. All firefighters in Montgomery County went there. The police went there. They had all sorts of two-year certificate programs. We could do the same thing in Washington, D.C. You know, graphic designers, for example, make a pretty good living. They can start at $40,000 or $50,000 a year. We have a great opportunity in hospitality here in the district in that we have so many restaurants and so many hotels. And that's another thing we could do. We could partner. The two biggest hotel chains, as I said in my opening statement, are here in our region, Marriott and Hilton. They're a few miles outside the district. Hilton's in Virginia, and Marriott's in Montgomery County in Maryland. We could partner with them as well to create jobs in our city, decent jobs in hotel management. You know, Cornell University in New York built a school around one of the finest schools in the world of hotel management. We could do the same thing here through programs in our community college, get kids started in the hospitality industry here in the district, which is a big thing. We have a lot of tourists in D.C. So those are some of the things that we could do. And I think we really need creative thinking, and we need to also make sure that we enforce First Source. We have a thing called First Source in the District of Columbia that requires that we hire district residents on contracting jobs, and we have some huge ones in the district.
Excuse me, are you talking about contracting like construction jobs?
Yes, construction jobs. So we have the single biggest federal construction job in America going on right now here in the district. It's the St. Elizabeth's project in Ward 8. We also are about to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to rebuild the Frederick Douglass Bridge. We're going to build a new stadium for our soccer team over in Southwest. It looks, well, we haven't agreed that it's going to be in Southwest yet, but we think it is. And all these projects use city money, and we should enforce First Source laws, but we don't because contractors tell us, among other things, that they can't find enough qualified people in the District of Columbia. So we need to train these people, need to partner with unions and other entities here in the district with business, and we need to train individuals to do things like welding and you know, ironwork and carpentry and the other things that we need in construction.
And quite frankly, jobs like a good plumber makes quite a bit. Sometimes, you know, it's amazing what they make an hour. So I do agree that is something I hadn't thought about. We have a question that Jennifer Skyped in, and she wanted to know, let me see this, she wanted to know, what do you think the minimum wage should be?
Well, you know what? I see that we also have a caller on line two. Can we get to them first?
Sure.
Yeah. Let's see, just because I don't want to lose them. Rose, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Well, what's your question, Rose? And then we'll get on to the minimum wage. What's your question?
Well, this ties in with the minimum wage, and basically it's with our current city council. When Walmart was getting ready to build some new stores here, the city council passed a bill, or at least I thought they passed a bill, that made it so that one employer would have to pay higher than the minimum wage. And I think that there was a big Walmart had a big problem with that, and I want to know what happened with it. Is that still going to take place? Are they going to make Walmart pay their employees more?
Well, that's a great question. And there was legislation. They dubbed it the big box store legislation, and it called for employers that made over $1 billion a year in profit nationally to pay a higher wage. And actually, it was a 50% higher wage. It was $12.50 an hour. And, of course, several of the big retailers fought this, Walmart fought it, Target fought it, Home Depot fought it. They didn't want this to happen. But the city council passed it anyway, and I applaud them for doing that. Unfortunately, the mayor vetoed the bill. He vetoed the bill based on the fact that Walmart had promised to open 6 stores in the District of Columbia. They had opened 2. They were in the midst of opening 2, and they said that they weren't going to open the other 4 if the wage went up, including one at the Skyland Shopping Center, Skyland Mall, over in Ward 7, which desperately needed a shopping center. So the mayor vetoed the bill because he said we would lose 1,800 jobs. I'm sorry, 1,800 jobs, and that we needed those jobs, and that Skyline needed an anchor store. And so they threw the baby out with the bathwater, because I think we allowed Walmart to bully us in that case, Rose, and I think that was wrong. If you're making minimum wage working at Walmart at $8.25 an hour, you're probably living in Maryland or Virginia. You're not paying taxes to the District of Columbia because you can't afford to live here. So we would have gotten a lot out of the $12.50 an hour. It would have allowed people with 2 wage earner families, I think, to continue to live in the district and continue to pay taxes. And I don't think we should be bullied by people that make over $1 billion a year in profit. I think Walmart, a single store, made something like $7 billion in profit last year. So, you know, they pay a lot of people to make sure that they keep their costs down. And I ran a business for 25 years, so I understand that. But I think it was the wrong decision. I think we should have made them pay the $12.50 an hour.
Well, may I ask you a question? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rose.
I was just going to say that had they gone with it, though, wouldn't that have made Walmart go someplace else? Because historically, Walmart has not built stores in populated areas. They've been in the suburbs.
Well, that's what Walmart said. They said they would go somewhere else if we did it. But we didn't do it. We vetoed it. They have agreed to open the Skyland store, but they haven't committed to the other two. Recollection is they still haven't committed to open the other two yet. So it's been a mixed bag after doing what they want. And I really don't think we can be bullied into that. I mean, I could tell you from running the business myself for 25 years, if there's a profit to be made, then we make it. And we accommodate additional costs and things like that in order to make the profit. And when you're making $7 billion a year, as a retail store, I think that you'll find a way to make a profit even if your wages go up a little bit. That's certainly the way I feel about it. Walmart and employers have always fought higher wages, and you understand that. But I think that we have to have the guts to stand up to these guys. You know, we lasted for 213 years without a Walmart in the city. And I think that's what I would have said if I was the mayor. I would have said, you know what, we've done, you know, for the past 213 years, we've done okay without you. I think we can survive.
Well, this is something that I've seen happen when Walmart enters into any place, whether it be a big city or a small town, is that they end up, you know, the small business owner, like the guy who would sell the magazines, the person who would sell baby clothes, you know, all those different departments that we as consumers would like to be in one place, and we like to be it as cheap as can be. I hate to say that I'm always referring back to New York, because I did see this also go away, was the small town, you know, small business owner who is not part of a national chain or regional chain, but maybe just has one store. So I would think that, playing devil's advocate, that kind of increase for $4, say from, $8.25 now to $12.50, about $4, would be a very difficult thing on a small business owner. And would it be right to say that there aren't very many of them in D.C.?
Well, I think there's still a lot of small businesses in D.C., but the big box legislation didn't really deal with them. It only dealt with Walmart. You had to make over $1 billion a year, so it wouldn't have affected small business at all.
Okay.
It would have actually given an advantage to small business because they could pay a lower wage. But
That's good. I was just concerned that it would really kind of blow.
You know, we see them disappearing, but that's a more complex problem than just wages. You know, that we all are a party to getting rid of the small businessman. It's terrible. I ran a small business. But, you know, we used to have a hardware store, for example, in Washington called Heckinger's. It was homegrown. It was made by a guy. It was started by a guy named John Heckinger, who actually was a well-known businessman, a philanthropist in Washington. But they were driven out of business by stores like Home Depot. And we helped in that regard, you know, because we all wanted to pay $10.95 a gallon for paint instead of $11.95. And now we all lament that you can't go to the hardware. You go to a hardware store and you ask them a question, they don't know what's going on.
Right.
You lose a lot with small businesses. And what we lose as a city with small businesses is jobs. Because small businesses hire local people, you're way more likely to be hired by the local food market or the local chain of clothing stores or something like that. In D.C., you're likely to be much more likely to be hired by them than you are by Walmart if you're a D.C. resident.
Well, I see. Okay, well, that does
explain
a lot.
Yeah, and we do need small business. You know, we just had a rally. I just spoke at a rally where there was a set-aside for small businesses where we had put $1 billion into the budget for small businesses. And as of the end of fiscal 2014, our fiscal year starts on October 1st, so at the end of this year, only 84 million of the 500 million that we were supposed to spend with small businesses have been spent. So that's, you know, $416 million that went to people that it wasn't supposed to go to.
Wow. You know, that's just, they should be really ashamed of themselves. I mean, when you set aside taxpayers' money to serve a certain purpose, such as what you said, and then they don't do it, it should be a crime. I mean, it should be something that is, you know, can cost you your job. I mean, anywhere else that would cost you a job if you didn't set aside money and then never used it and never went forth with it. So why do you think that is? Why did they not spend the money?
Well, you know, I think it's because it's easy to succumb to the pressure that's put on the city council by other people in the city that want the money, and that it, you know, sometimes it's hard to walk the straight and narrow path, but we have to do that. You're absolutely right. It is a crime. You shouldn't be able to spend money that's been set aside for small businesses with large businesses. That's just totally untenable, and it hurts us all in the long run. But unfortunately, we will get into this in great detail next week, because next week we're going to talk about honest government and statehood and other issues like that. But we don't have the most honest government here in the District of Columbia. And it's not really because anybody sets out, I think, to be corrupt on things like this. I just think it's really easy to do the things that are easy, and tough to do the things that are tough. I mean, I hate to sound like Yogi Berra here, but that's the truth. It's, you know, you have to look for the small businesses. They have to apply for the money, and they're easy to ignore in order to take care of the big business interests in the district. And I think that's wrong, and we have to stop that, and we need people on the city council.
I have a question that just came in. Sorry to interrupt you.
Okay, that's your job.
Yes, my job is to limit the ability for you to speak continuously. I'm just joking.
Good luck.
Yes, that is true. Very good luck. I have a question here that says, okay, the bill, I guess he meant that legislation or that bill, would have increased the minimum wage to $12.50. Doesn't it make more sense to raise the minimum wage by increments over a certain term of years?
Well, certainly people make that argument, and you know, it certainly on several levels makes more sense. And there is legislation now to raise it to the $12.50 mark by 2016. The reason I'm in favor of raising it more now is because I think that $12.50 an hour in the District of Columbia with the cost of living is a just livable wage. But, you know, you certainly could make that argument that, you know, it helps to ease it in for business. But I think as government people, people that work for the city council, people that work for the betterment of the government, we don't want to do things that cripple job creation, but I think we have a responsibility to people to make sure that we're paying them a decent, livable wage, and it seems to me that less than $16,000 a year in the District of Columbia is a reasonable wage. And, you know, we have all sorts of things you can do to get around it. There's a thing it's called a training wage or young people's wage, where you can pay as little as $4.25 an hour for the first 90 days of somebody's employment. Also, I think they just raised tip workers get $2.30 an hour, I think $2.30 an hour. And these are people, very often, we got to remember that these are people that very often do not get benefits. Not the kind of benefits that full-time employees get at things like government jobs and at law firms and, you know, in the city government or in the federal government. Hospitalization, retirement, these things very often don't come with minimum wage jobs. So at Walmart, you know, much to I guess their credit, they do get some of those benefits. So,
well, let me ask you a question. I know in many parts of the United States, Walmart only hires part-time employees,
right,
so that they don't get these benefits.
Right.
Is that the case here in D.C.?
Yeah, I think it is the case here in D.C. too. We don't have enough experience with Walmart yet, I think, to know the answers to those questions. They have only been in town for a very short period of time. But since past is prologue, I think we have every reason to have to be very cautious with them because we assume that they will continue to do what they've always done.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Well, there's another question here, and I think it's one very much like the previous one. Wouldn't it be better for small businesses to increase the minimum wage to $10.25? That's $2. And then wait for another 4 years and do another $2. That being able to give the small business owner who maybe only employs 4 or 5 employees a chance at not going bankrupt.
Well, you know, I think that I don't think we need to take it out on the employee. I don't think that we need to sustain small businesses by on the backs of employees. I think if we want to make things better for small businesses, that we do things like give them the $416 million that's missing from the set-aside that we've promised to give them. I think we can give them tax incentives to make it easier to lower their costs doing business. I think that we can give them other accommodations, but I don't think we need to take it out on the worker in order to sustain small business. I think we have a responsibility to support small business. As I say, I think there's not only a responsibility on our part, but I think there's a real benefit in doing it, that we benefit as a community by having these people that provide jobs in our community. 75% of all jobs in America are given out by small business. So I think that we all have a vested interest in keeping small business alive. I just don't think we need to do it on the backs of the workers. I think that government needs to step up to the plate and take the responsibility for helping small business. Because, as I said, I ran a business for 25 years, and it really doesn't matter to you as a businessman how your cost gets reduced, if your cost gets reduced. You know, that's the important thing for you, to be able to compete. And if you can't compete because your costs are too high, it doesn't matter to you whether you're getting a tax break or whether you're lowering the wage, as far as I can see. So I think that there are other ways to address the problems that small business have with costs without taking it out on wage earners. And we've seen this with unions over and over again, where they've negotiated contracts that are in favor of their employees. And, union workers don't make $8.25 an hour. There are a lot of people that have skilled and semi-skilled jobs in our society that don't make minimum wage.
In other words, they make more than that? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they make more than that. And I think that all those businesses survive. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that small businesses have a hard time. They struggle. But don't forget, the number one reason that small businesses go out of business in America is not due to wages, not due to increasing costs. It's due to undercapitalization. Most small businesses go out of business because they're undercapitalized. And one of the reasons that they're undercapitalized is that we make it easy for people to start businesses, because we believe in that as Americans. We believe in competition. We believe in freedom. So you can go out and start a restaurant tomorrow if you want to start a restaurant. But the problem is that most restaurants that close didn't have enough money to open in the first place.
Well, you know, it's really sad. I mean, I think I see, this might be a personal comment on my side, but I just see the small business guy, just the owner of one store, basically vanishing along with the middle class. I think it's getting to the point with regulations and taxes that it's just quite impossible to start your own business. But let me just put out this one more time, the phone number, 888-429-5471. And if you don't mind calling in and giving Mr. Brown a good question, we would really appreciate it. I think we're going to go for another 5 minutes. And then we'll be closing up, so hopefully someone out there will call in. I was just going to say also that, this show is on jobs and wages, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So while we wait for someone, because we've kind of gone over our hour, why don't you give us a summation of what you would do or what you plan to do, what your view is, what the city council should be doing in the next term, on jobs and wages?
Well, I think they need to do several things. I think that we need to invest in more partnership opportunities with business and the federal government. I think we need to invest in more job training programs and vocational programs at our high school level and community college level. I think we need to develop programs at our community college that serve the city. I think we need to do the same thing in high school. There are very few of them in the District of Columbia, and we need more of them. I think that we also have to partner with unions and other employers in the district to employ D.C. residents. I think that you should be able to have give incentives to employers to hire D.C. residents like we do in First Source. I think we need to enforce the First Source laws and that we need to also provide other incentives. You know, in the District of Columbia, if you own a house and you live in the house, you get a thing called the homestead exemption, which exempts you from the first, I believe it's $30,000 of the value of your house in terms of property taxes. And the idea behind that is that we want to keep you, we want to keep, help housing prices in the District of Columbia and, by keeping people in their houses. Properties are better maintained. The market is a little less volatile when people own and live in their own houses. I think we should do the same thing for jobs. I think if you own a small business in the district and you hire district residents in that business, you should get an incentive for it through your taxes. I think that because, you know, we get that money back by the people that work for you that live in the city that pay the taxes. So it's a win-win as far as I can see. I think we also need to do, like I said, we need to get Marriott and Hilton and other people to take advantage of our infrastructure and being at the center of this, you know, our region and our community and all that it has to offer. You know, we were just, was it Forbes magazine, I think, that just called us the coolest place in America to live. I think those people need to step up to the plate a little, along with the federal government, and help provide some of that programming. I think we can do a lot to help jobs. I think we just don't care enough about it, excuse me, at the city council level. And we've been lucky in Washington. We've had a economy that's traditionally been you know, insulated from really bad times because of the federal government and other people in our region, other employers. So I don't think we've put the effort into it that we need to put into it.
Well, thank you. That was very informative. And, you know, we do have sometimes a difference in opinion. So I want to thank you for listening to me and some of the stuff that I brought up. Because I do like to play the devil's advocate. And I think it is a very volatile issue, you know, for those on both sides of the coin. And, you know, I've never really owned a small business, but I have many, many friends struggling to keep their small businesses going with so much regulations and taxes. And I'm sure that's a whole other conversation that you could have, so on the regulations and taxing of small businesses. But I do want to thank everyone for joining us. And please, please tune in next week on the same channel at the same time, 2 p.m., for our discussion next time on affordable, sustainable growth. This town hall meeting will be archived on our campaign website, and I encourage you to share it with others who are interested in the upcoming election. Remember that you can submit questions to the campaign website for this meeting or the upcoming meeting next week, and we will do our best to answer as many as possible. And we thank you all for those who have sent them in. Again, that address is www.michaeldbrown2014.com. Again, the website is www.michaeldbrown2014.com. Before I sign off, Michael, is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, just one small correction. We actually we did the affordable sustainable growth last week, and next week is honest government.
Don't
forget to tune in for that, and hopefully that one will start exactly on time because we got a lot to cover on honest government
and
also
statehood. Yes, I'm surprised that statehood is not one on its own, because that is, you know, that has become the new, it seems to me, key word. All of a sudden you hear everyone either talking about it or getting their pictures taken with, you know, the D.C. flag. It's quite amazing to see, and I do apologize for that. It just is amazing how quickly time has gone by, because it doesn't seem like we're already on to our fourth town hall meeting. And I want to say to the public that I think that we have done something that's been innovative to try to reach out to people, because it's very, very difficult without a whole bunch of money to be able to pay for commercials or advertising and get interviewed and be able to get what you stand for out there in the public. But we understand that people now are talking about doing what we've been doing for a very long time, is having an internet radio show in which people could call in and ask questions. So, you know, I guess, what do they say, people who copy you, that's actually flattery or something like that? What is the saying? That when people...
You should sue them, I think is the saying. If people are copying you, sue them. Copying you is a form of flattery,
I guess. That's right.
And you know what? It's really just, that's the last thing I want to say today. And it's really got to be about you. That's what government's got to be about. In the District of Columbia, unfortunately, for the last several years, it's been more about the people inside the Wilson Building than the people outside the Wilson Building. And we really need to change that, because this is what government service should be about. It should be about making life better for the people of the District of Columbia. And if it's not about that, you should do something else.
That's true. And again, it's time, D.C., for Michael D. Brown to be elected to the City Council. And I'm very emphatic, and I'm happy to say that I see a lot of people who are very, are behind you and getting somebody who's not part of the machine, not part of endorsements, and not part of big money. So again, I want to remind everyone that when you get out to vote on November the 4th, you're going to vote for two. Don't forget that. A lot of people seem, the statistics show, some people don't vote for their second, I guess it would be seat.
Yeah, about 50%, actually.
That's just crazy.
That's crazy.
If you're going to vote for one, you got to vote for two, and you got to go online, and you've got to do some research. And if you go on to the website, www.michaeldbrown2014.com, you will see all the issues and your experience and your history and everything that you believe so passionately about. So with that being said, I'd like to read this disclaimer. This program is paid for by Michael D. Brown for Council 2014, Patricia E. Brown, Treasurer, 4501 Western Avenue, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20016. A copy of our report is on file with the Director of the Office of Campaign Finance for the District of Columbia. This program is produced by BBS Radio, and all rights are reserved. Again, thank you out there. Don't forget, join next Sunday, 2 p.m., where we're going to talk about honest government and statehood. Thank you.